and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the works of Philodemus. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Richard Yanko, a professor of classics at the University of Michigan. He's the author of many books, commentaries, and translations of Homer, Aristotle, and Philodemus, and he's a member of the papyrology team of the Vesuvius Challenge, which is helping to recover new texts from the ancient world. He joins us by Zoom as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Richard, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Pleasure to be here, John.
Why are the works of Philodemus, when you bring them all together and study them, why are they a great book?
Well, I'm going to reveal to you that I think I'm an imposter on your program, because I wouldn't say that Philodemus is the author of a great book. I would say he's an author of very useful books. And as a poet, he has claims to be a great poet, but we don't have very much of his great poetry. I can certainly illustrate his great poetry, but with his corpus of books, we get them through papyri, which were burned in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, and they didn't come down through the usual ways that great books get transmitted to us from antiquity. They came down through random selection. It's a random selection, which happens to be the study of a house philosopher of one of the great Roman aristocrats, Julius Caesar's father, Calpurnius Piso. So what we're getting is the contents of a scholar's study. And if, perchance, my study were preserved miraculously for millennia, you'd get a lot of scholarly books. You'd get some great ones too, but a lot of them would be books about books of less interest to the great books public. But what's amazing about him is that he gives us lots of insight into various of the great books that we know from antiquity via the Renaissance and the medieval tradition.
We are going to talk about all of that. Who is this figure, Philodemus? Why is he interesting? What we know about him, how we're still learning more, the rediscovery of what he wrote, and the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. Richard, there are so many places we could begin with the works of Philodemus, but let's start with his epigrams, for which he is well known. Today, we think of epigrams as pithy and clever sayings. What are the epigrams of Philodemus?
They are actually love poems, a lot of them. Some of them quite risque. There's also poems that encapsulate his philosophy. They're extremely witty in Greek. They're not very long, but, you know, we have about 30 of them, and they're very brilliant. It's good stuff.
If they're poems, why do we call them epigrams?
They're called epigrams because these kinds of poems originate in things you put on stone. So they could be epitaphs put on gravestones, this kind of thing. What we call epigrammatic, that is, they're sort of witty and pointed and skillful poems.
And they're short.
Yeah. So let me read you one. Artemidorus has given us a cabbage, Aristarchus salt fish, Athenagoras baby onions, Philodemus a liver, Apollophanes 2 pounds of pork, and there were three left over from yesterday. Let's get going, my lad. Let's get garlands and slippers and unguent. I want dinner brought in at 4 o'clock sharp.
Why do you like that one?
It's just a simple meal. And he's celebrating the Epicurean virtue of living simply. And also, for your listeners, it's not too risque. There's another one that illustrates his philosophical ideal. Tomorrow from 3 o'clock, my dear Piso, your poetic friend drags you to his humble cottage, giving a dinner for the anniversary of Epicurus' birthday, the 20th. If you find no udders or kiosk-born draughts of wine, yet you'll see true friends, yet you'll hear things far sweeter than ancient Phaeacia did, where Odysseus told his story. And if ever you turn your eyes even towards me, Piso, we shall celebrate a richer instead of a humbler 20th. Now, Piso is his patron, and he's inviting him to a simple dinner. And he's actually hinting that he'd like Piso to keep funding him, I suppose, by saying we'll celebrate a richer instead of a humbler 20th because of the vast disparity of wealth between the two guys. But both he and Piso were adherents of Epicurean philosophy.
Let's pause there on Epicurean. You've used this word a couple of times now. What is Epicurean philosophy? My impression is that it's about living for today, party all the time, pursue pleasure. It's like the opposite of Stoicism. Is that correct?
No. This is a sense of Epicureanism that was given to it by people who were hostile, starting with Cicero. Cicero didn't like Epicureanism. He thought it understated the role of the gods in the world. But in fact, Epicurus defined the highest good as pleasure, but he defined pleasure as the avoidance of pain. And he thought that things that cause you trouble in the long run are best avoided. And in that, he included too much wine, women, and song. He thought it should be in moderation, and that if you overdo things, you're actually worse off. In fact, he advocated a simple life led among friends. But Cicero's objection above everything was that Epicurus thought that the gods are so far removed from the world that they don't actually intervene in it. They live in the spaces between the worlds, and they are just happy out there, and we should worship them and celebrate them, but they don't actually intervene in the world. And that's where Cicero parted company with him, and so did the Stoics.
Epicurus was Greek. He lived about two centuries before Philodemus, who lived from 110 to 35 BC. Where does Philodemus fit into this school of thought we call Epicurean?
Well, he's a fairly faithful follower of Epicurus. He was a student of a philosopher called Zeno of Sidon, whom Cicero also heard lectures from in Athens when he spent his college year abroad in Athens in the 80s BCE. But then Athens went through a very bad time. The Mithridatic Wars displaced a lot of people. It may be also that Philodemus was passed over in the succession for the headship of the school. And he ended up in Italy. And he ended up as the house philosopher of Calpurnius Piso, Julius Caesar's father-in-law, whose daughter was the Calpurnia who appears in Shakespeare. So he perhaps lived in Piso's villa, or at the very least, he had a study in Piso's villa. It sounds actually from that poem I just read you that he had a humble dwelling somewhere else, probably in Herculaneum itself. And he was the teacher of a lot of very prominent Romans, including Virgil and the other leading poets of Augustan Rome, perhaps also including Horace. It's not certain he met Horace, but it's quite possible.
We'll turn to his time in Italy in just a moment, but I want to step back and look at the wider Roman world in which Philodemus lived and wrote. There's a cosmopolitanism to him, it seems. He was born in 110 BC in what is now Jordan, near the Sea of Galilee. He wrote in Greek. Was he Greek? Was he Roman? Was he cosmopolitan? How should we think about him? And what was the world like that he lived and wrote in?
Well, Gadara is actually a site that straddles the border between Jordan and Israel. But he came from a very unusual town. Gadara produced a lot of Greek-speaking intellectuals for a couple of centuries. It must have had a very good Greek education system. So it produced another epigrammatist, Meleager. It produced a writer on Stoicism later, Oinomaeus of Gadara. It had quite a series of intellectuals come from there. I think he regarded himself as Greek. What his ancestry was, I don't know, obviously. He seems to have been educated, though, first in Alexandria, which was the nearby main intellectual capital. And then he moved to Athens, which, following its decline as leader of the Greek world, became the center, the intellectual capital of the Greek world, and a place where Romans would go to be educated. And so he probably saw an opportunity in Athens. He must have met various Romans for whatever reason, ended up in Italy from there. But of course, one has to remember that Greek was the English of antiquity. We tend to think of Latin as the most important language, but really the lingua franca, certainly in the eastern half of the Roman Empire and much further east, was Greek. In the old days, when computers were starting to have the corpora of Greek and Latin on them, I remember that if you wanted to search all of Latin, it took 10 minutes, whereas to run a computer search on the whole of Greek took an hour and a half, because there's so much more written in Greek down to the end of antiquity than there is written in Latin.
So he finds himself in Italy, where he becomes the teacher of Virgil, of all people, the author of the Aeneid. How do we know about this connection? And do we see in Virgil any influence from Philodemus?
Great question. We know about it from Philodemus because he dedicated a 10-volume work of his on virtues and vices to Virgil, Varius, Plotius Tucker, and Quintus Varus, who were three other great leading poets of Augustan Rome. We also know about Virgil's Epicurean links from Virgil's earliest poems. Virgil actually studied with another Epicurean on the Bay of Naples, a man called Ciro. And Ciro lived in Naples itself. And Virgil actually writes a poem to him, saying he's going to study with him. And so in Virgil's earliest work, we can see Epicurean influence. But over the course of Virgil's career, he moves away from the Epicureans and towards the Stoics, which was more in line with Augustus's preferences and, I think, more in line with Virgil's.
And along the way, of course, Philodemus is doing a lot of writing. We sampled the poetic epigrams a moment ago, but he also wrote on ethics and aesthetics. He seems to have really good range as a writer. There's philosophy, there's art, there's all of that. Is that true? Was he like that?
Oh, yes. He wrote on a great range of topics in prose. One of his most accessible works is called On the Good King According to Homer. And he actually wrote about how Homer provides a good model for leadership, and in particular, monarchical leadership, because that was the model of leadership in the Hellenistic East. In fact, a proconsul like Calpurnius Piso would have had almost monarchical power when he was proconsul in Macedonia. So he actually takes lots of examples from Homer, talking about what a good king Nestor is and things like this, or Odysseus in the Odyssey. Then he uses the example of the successors of Alexander, who all invited one another to dinner and then poisoned each other at the dinners, to illustrate what it's like not to be a good ruler. So those are the two aspects of that work. Then he wrote about virtues and vices. As I said, he writes a book about flattery. He writes a book about slander. He writes about pride. There are all of these discussions of the virtues and vices. He also wrote on the history of philosophy. He wrote about Epicurus. He wrote histories of the academic school of philosophers. He wrote about the Stoics, the history of the Stoics, and preserves a lot of historical information about them. And that, by the way, is the only book which is ever referred to in antiquity other than his epigrams. It was mentioned in Diogenes Laertius's Lives of the Philosophers. He certainly writes about the history of philosophy. And then he writes about aesthetics. He writes about The Effect of Music in his On Music, which was in four volumes. He writes about poetry, which was in five volumes. He writes about rhetoric, which was probably in about 10 volumes. He wrote a great many books, and that's what we have from the library at Herculaneum, other than also a small collection of Roman literature, which was found probably somewhere else in the same villa.
So let's talk about how we know his works at all. First of all, there's a medieval manuscript tradition where his works survive through the Renaissance. What comes down to us that way?
Yes, but we only have 30 epigrams through that tradition. And we know he wrote about 150 because a book of first lines, listing first lines, came to light, an ancient list of his epigrams. You get little fragments which tantalize us, in Naples once, or she was 16, or we can only speculate about how that one ended. And there's a whole series of epigram beginnings there, but we know they're his because the ones that do survive are also included. So there's that. But that's all we have through the medieval transmission, which the monks faithfully copied down.
You've mentioned Herculaneum a couple of times now, and this is critically important for what we know about Philodemus. First of all, what is Herculaneum? Where is it? And what do we find there?
Herculaneum was a prosperous Roman town, founded actually by Greeks on the Bay of Naples. It is just south of Naples, just north of Pompeii, which everybody knows was buried in ash by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79 AD. Herculaneum was a more upmarket town than Pompeii. It had a lot of luxury villas on the north side of town, outside the city wall, was this magnificent villa discovered in 1709 when someone was digging a well. It contained a great wealth of bronze statues, marble statues, mosaics, wall paintings. In 1750, they actually tunneled into it. It was King Charles III, the Bourbon King of Naples, actually engaged a military engineer to tunnel into the villa to extract all these treasures. And in the course of removing treasures from the villa, they found what appeared to be a wall full of pigeonholes, of mailboxes, effectively. And these actually contained what they first thought were lumps of coal. And they brought some up and they tried burning them. And then one of them must have broken open and they saw writing on the inside. And they understood that these were books. And this was a very exciting discovery back in 1754.
So, Richard, they find these lumps of coal, these lumps of charcoal. They could read them, but mostly they couldn't read them.
Right. It wasn't easy because the ink is black and the background is black. And also, they were rolled up scrolls. If they broke one open, they'd only get one layer of writing. For a long time, they opened them by cutting them either side with a knife, scraping out the middle, and just taking a layer with writing on it to show the king. But that was extremely destructive. There were 800 scrolls found, and at a certain point, an expert came from the Vatican, Father Antonio Piaggio. He devised a machine for unrolling the scrolls continuously. You could only do it for the middles of the scrolls because the outsides had the layers compacted together. But he devised this machine, which unrolled, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch a day, something like that. It took forever to unroll these scrolls. And when they did unroll them, they had lots of holes. But it was, you know, a reasonably effective method. The first one he unrolled was the On Music of Philodemus. And then the unrolling continued. And we have parts of probably 400 or 500 scrolls unrolled by this method, although quite a lot of the results of the unrolling were pretty disastrous. But we do have quite a corpus, and that's how we know that this library contained, as I said, some Roman literature. There's a play by a contemporary of Plautus and Terence, a comedy called The Moneylender. There's a part of a speech by Seneca the Elder to the imperial family, which we didn't have. And there's a poem about the Battle of Actium, whose author we still can't identify, but it's obviously quite a good poem. We have book 9 of that. But then we have this philosophical library comprising the works of Philodemus, most of all. And some of those works are actually his autographs. There's one where someone has added on the backs of the scrolls passages that were left out on the front. So he's obviously revising his own work in that case. And then we have works by his predecessors, above all by Epicurus, also by some of his opponents, like the Stoic Chrysippus, who doesn't otherwise survive at all. So this was an incredibly important discovery because it was a library. It's the only place in the ancient world where a library was buried in conditions that would ensure its survival.
And we're learning more all the time about what's in this library, what's in these scrolls, as we bring new technologies to bear on deciphering what these lumps of charcoal actually say. There's a current project called the Vesuvius Challenge, and you're a part of it. What is the Vesuvius Challenge, and what are we learning right now in 2024 about the works of Philodemus and others?
Well, it's terribly exciting. I suppose the first breakthrough in technology was based on technology developed for NASA. NASA developed ways of imaging very remote and very dark planets. In the late 1990s, people turned this imaging technology onto the Herculaneum papyri and enabled us to get much better images where you could really see the ink. That was transformative in the first place. So over the past 20, 30 years, scholars have started reconstructing the books that were opened in the old way. I've done 4 of them, and each one that I did took me about, probably 5 or 6 years, not full time, because I teach. I have to teach my undergraduates and show them that the Greeks were the first people to invent a computer. But among other things, that is a very laborious thing to do. And of course, alongside the 530 or so scrolls that were opened by the old method, there's 270 which were thought too fragile to open, even with that method. And those scrolls have been the focus of the Vesuvius Challenge.
And so the Vesuvius Challenge now is doing exactly what to learn what's inside these scrolls?
The Vesuvius Challenge started out with a wonderful computer scientist, Brent Seals, at the University of Kentucky. And he was devising technologies for smoothing out manuscripts so that you could see them flat. Medieval manuscripts, for example, on parchment, have undulating surfaces, and he smoothed out images of the Doomsday Book in the British Library so that they could have the patrons of the British Library scroll through and see where their villages are listed, 1,000 years ago. And then from there, he realized, I don't quite know how, that there were all these scrolls which were still rolled up, and he wanted to see if he could see inside them. Back in 2005, he came to Ann Arbor because the University of Michigan has the largest collection of ancient manuscripts in the Western Hemisphere, and medieval Greek manuscripts too, by the way. And he wanted to test on our collection his techniques. And he succeeded in showing that we could see the writing lying underneath the upper layers in a manuscript that actually turned out to be in Hebrew, because then we took it apart And we verified his results by showing that it could be confirmed by physical removal. But the Herculaneum scrolls were the toughest challenge of all because the ink is written in carbon black, that is soot, which is very similar to the carbon out of which ancient paper, papyrus, is made. Whereas medieval manuscripts, like the ones he first tested, have their ink based on iron filings dissolved in water. So those show up in X-rays. So he got scans, very high resolution scans, from the diamond light source in Oxford of the papyri that the Herculaneum papyri that are kept in Paris. And with those, he put together a project to unroll them digitally and then flatten out the layers inside the scrolls so that you could actually read them and recognize the ink. Now, there was no technology for recognizing the ink. He developed the software for making the layers flat so you could follow the writing on a particular column. But he had no means of recognizing the ink. So Nat Friedman, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, put together a fund of $1 million for a prize for the first technician to come up with a way of recognizing the ink in these scans. His method worked. Earlier this last year, the challenge was announced, and the grand prize of almost $1 million was awarded in December, and it was won by three young people.
So with these new insights, we are learning brand new things about Philodemus. You've devoted a lot of your life to the study of Philodemus. What do you know about him today from these new insights that you didn't know a year or two ago?
What we now know is that we are going to be able to read the rest of these papyri. The grand prize yielded a new scroll, the last 16 columns of a new scroll. The style is that of Philodemus. They haven't read the title yet at the end of the scroll, but it's going to be there, in which Philodemus is talking about different kinds of pleasure. He's talking about the pleasure that you get from simple versus luxurious food, a big topic for the Roman Empire when they were really involved in gourmet dining in a big way. And we all know about the excesses of Roman banquets. Then he mentions various other kinds of pleasure, pleasures from sound. He talks about the man Xenophantus, who was somebody who just couldn't stop himself laughing. He mentions various other aspects of pleasure. So he's comparing probably the pleasures of sound with the pleasures of food. And I suspect it comes from one of the lost books of his on music, because it actually mentions the word music twice. But what's really exciting about this is not so much what's in this new text, but the potential that it opens up to read hundreds of more texts.
So do we even know how many texts remain to be deciphered? Are there more to be discovered? And Richard, when you let your imagination run wild, what do you think might be there to discover? Could there be a lost work of Aristotle, the complete works of Philodemus, or something from the Holy Land? Who knows? What might be there?
That's a great question. The collection we've got now, the 270 scrolls, we're probably going to know what those are. They're going to turn out to be similar to what we already have. That is, some new Latin literature. So we're going to get Roman literature here. Then we're also going to get more ancient philosophy. And it could be Philodemus, it could be the Stoics. That's what we're most likely to get. But what really gets me excited is that it's unbelievable that this was the main library in the villa of the Pisones. The villa almost certainly belonged to the same family when the eruption happened, as it belonged to in Philodemus's time, because otherwise they would have cleared out Philodemus's books. So it's incredible that a Roman aristocrat like Piso, one of the most powerful men in Rome, would not have had a proper library of his own. And when they excavated in the 1750s, they did find a room with a tiered semicircular seating, just like a lecture room. And so there must have been a main library in this villa. And we know of individuals, ordinary individuals, not aristocrats, who had libraries of 40,000 scrolls. We know that Faustus Sulla, the son of the dictator Sulla, had a library on the Bay of Naples with the original autograph manuscripts of Aristotle in it. And Cicero went there in order to write some of his philosophical works. Actually, I think he wrote De Officiis on duties there. So, you know, it's very likely indeed that there's a really much bigger library. And one of the objections of the archaeologists to looking for this library has been that if we find more books, we won't be able to open them or read them without ruining them, as was done to a lot of the books in the 18th century. Well, that objection doesn't count anymore, because we can read more ancient books. And that's the place where they're going to come from in the ancient world. There's nowhere else that preserved books in this way, where they were carbonized, turned to burnt newspaper, but not actually burned up. And that's what's extraordinary to me and hopeful to me about this library. So I want the works of Sappho. I think she was one of the greatest poets of antiquity. We only have about 5 poems of her complete. I would like the 9 books that she wrote. I would certainly like the Lost Dialogues of Aristotle. I've been very interested in what Aristotle said in the Lost Book of his Poetics about comedy. I would like to have that. Those sorts of things ought to be in a villa like Piso's. And I'd like somebody to excavate them.
So we may be on the brink of exciting new discoveries thanks to this groundbreaking technology that gives us more ancient literature. And so, right. Richard, just taking a step back, how did you become interested in this subject yourself? How did you become a scholar? Why did you become a scholar of ancient literature and wanted to devote your life to the study of Philodemus and his friends?
Well, I didn't start out with Philodemus. I started out with Homer. I read the Odyssey in translation when I was very young. And my father actually had, he was an electrician, and he had a client across the valley who was very much a lover of Greece and all things Greek. He gave me books to read. Another client of my father had a load of classics books in his garden shed that he hadn't used since he went to school in the 1930s. And he gave me these moldy books, which he brought out in a wheelbarrow. That changed my life. He didn't want these books, but they really changed my life. That's how I became interested. As for Philodemus, well, I had to teach Aristotle's Poetics in my first job. And I read in a very old edition of the Poetics that there was a manuscript, a summary of the Lost Book of his Poetics on comedy in Paris. I went to study it. I wrote a book about it. And after I published the book, I saw a scholarly article by an old scholar who had died complaining that nobody had noticed his article of 1955 about a critique of Aristotle's Poetics by Philodemus. So I went back and I found that in that article of 1955, he referred to a German of 1909 who complained that nobody had noticed his article of 1862 about this papyrus. So I decided I had to go to Naples and look at this stuff. And when I got there, I was just amazed at how much there was to do and how few people were interested in it. The Italians showed me a papyrus full of quotations of Homer, and they said, you should do it. And I said, well, I came here to do my papyrus. Oh, why don't one of you do it? And they said, well, we're already committed to doing such and such. And so it never got done. And it's still not published. I know that now. And, you know, there's just so much there to do. And nobody seems to want to do it because it's a difficult area. But there's a great deal to find out. So I got excited about Philodemus, and I decided that this material needed to be redone, particularly after the new technology began to help us, the multispectral imaging in the late 1990s. So I've been bringing out Philodemus along the way, although he's not the only author I work on. I'm still working on Homer a bit.
One more question, Richard. Let's wrap up with this. At the top of the show, you said Philodemus may not have written great books, but he wrote useful books. What can we learn from him today? How is Philodemus useful to us?
He's useful first, I think, because he puts the record straight on what Epicureans thought. Their philosophy was far from being as simplistic as Cicero wants to make out. And Plutarch, too, didn't care for it. And then he's useful because he preserves lots and lots of things that we wouldn't know in any other way. New fragments of poetry, lots of information about earlier philosophers, lots of information about historical events that we didn't know about, all sorts of things about the ancient world, which the ancient world has not transmitted to us in any other way. So his stuff is very useful, very nice acquisition, and it really fills out a lot of information about the truly great authors who are out there.
Richard Yanko, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the works of Philodemus.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I wish all your listeners a very good day.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.